So ended the adventure of the Misty Mountains. Soon Bilbo's stomach was feeling full and comfortable again, and he felt he could sleep contentedly, though really he would have liked a loaf and butter better than bits of meat roasted on sticks. He slept curled up on the hard rock, more soundly than ever he had done on his feather bed in his own little hole at home. But all night he dreamed of his own house, and wandered in his sleep into all his different rooms, looking for something that he could not find, nor remember what it looked like. Chapter 7 Queer Lodgings. The next morning, Bilbo woke up with the early sun in his eyes. He jumped up to look at the time, and to go and put his kettle on, and found he was not at home at all. So he sat down and wished in vain for a wash and a brush. He did not get either, nor tea, nor toast, nor bacon for his breakfast, only cold mutton and rabbit, and after that he had to get ready for a fresh start. This time he was allowed to climb onto an eagle's back and cling between his wings. The air rushed over him, and he shut his eyes. The dwarves were crying farewells and promised to repay the Lord of the Eagles if ever they could, as off rose 15 great birds from the mountain side. The sun was still close to the eastern edge of things. The morning was cool, and mists were in the valleys and hollows, and twined here and there about the peaks and pinnacles of the hills. Bilbo opened an eye to peep, and saw that the birds were already high up, and the world was far away, and the mountains were falling back behind them into the distance. He shut his eyes again and held on tighter.
"Don't pinch," said the eagle. "You need not be frightened like a rabbit, even if you look rather like one. It is a fair morning with little wind. What is finer than flying?"
Bilbo would have liked to say, "A warm bath and late breakfast on the lawn afterwards," but he thought it better to say nothing at all, and to let go his clutch just a tiny bit. After a good while, the eagles must have seen the point they were making for, even from their great height, for they began to go down circling round in great spirals. They did this for a long while, and at last the hobbit opened his eyes again. The earth was much nearer, and below them were trees that looked like oaks and elms, and wide grasslands, and a river running through it all. But cropping out of the ground, right in the path of the stream which looped itself about it, was a great rock, almost a hill of stone, like a last outpost of the distant mountains, or a huge piece cast miles into the plain by some giant among giants. Quickly now, to the top of this rock, the eagles swooped one by one and set down their passengers.
"Farewell," they cried. "Wherever you fare, till your eyries receive you at the journey's end."
That is the polite thing to say among eagles.
"May the wind under your wings bear you where the sun sails and the moon walks," answered Gandalf, who knew the correct reply.
And so they parted, and though the Lord of the Eagles became, in after days, the king of all birds, and wore a golden crown, and his 15 chieftains golden collars, made of the gold that the dwarves gave them, Bilbo never saw them again, except high and far off in the Battle of Five Armies. But as that comes in at the end of this tale, we will say no more about it just now. There was a flat space on the top of the hill of stone, and a well-worn path with many steps leading down it to the river, across which a ford of huge flat stones led to the grassland beyond the stream. There was a little cave, a wholesome one with a pebbly floor, at the foot of the steps and near the end of the stony ford. Here the party gathered and discussed what was to be done.
"I always meant to see you all safe, if possible, over the mountains," said the wizard. "Now, by good management and good luck, I've done it.
Indeed, we're now a good deal further east than I ever meant to come with you, for after all, this is not my adventure. I may look in on it again before it's all over, but in the meanwhile, I've some other pressing business to attend to."
The dwarves groaned and looked most distressed, and Bilbo wept. They had begun to think Gandalf was going to come all the way, and would always be there to help them out of difficulties.
"I'm not going to disappear this very instant," said he. "I can give you a day or two more. Probably I can help you out of your present plight, and I need a little help myself. We've no food, and no baggage, and no ponies to ride, and you don't know where you are. Now I can tell you that. You're still some miles north of the path which we should have been following if we'd not left the mountain pass in a hurry. Very few people live in these parts, unless they've come in since I was last down this way, which is some years ago. But there is somebody that I know of who lives not far away. That somebody made the steps on the great rock. The Carrick, I believe he calls it. He does not come here often, certainly not in the daytime, and it's no good waiting for him. In fact, it would be very dangerous. We must go and find him, and if all goes well at our meeting, I think I shall be off and wish you, like the eagles, farewell wherever you fare."
They begged him not to leave them. They offered him dragon gold and silver and jewels, but he would not change his mind.
"We shall see, we shall see," he said, "and I think I've earned already some of your dragon gold, when you've got it."
After that they stopped pleading. Then they took off their clothes and bathed in the river, which was shallow and clear and stony at the ford. When they dried in the sun, which was now strong and warm, they were refreshed, if still sore and a little hungry. Soon they crossed the ford, carrying the hobbit, and then began to march through the long green grass and down the lines of the wide-armed oaks and the tall elms.
"And why is it called the Carrick?" asked Bilbo as he went along at the wizard's side.
"He called it the Carrick because Carrick is his word for it. He calls things like that Carricks, and this one is the Carrick because it's the only one near his home and he knows it well."
"Who calls it? Who knows it?"
"There's somebody I spoke of, a very great person. You must all be very polite when I introduce you. I shall introduce you slowly, two by two, I think, and you must be careful not to annoy him, or heaven knows what will happen. He can be appalling when he's angry, though he's kind enough if humoured. Still, I warn you, he gets angry easily."
The dwarves all gathered round when they heard the wizard talking like this to Bilbo.
"Is that the person you're taking us to now?" they asked. "Couldn't you find someone more easy-tempered? Hadn't you better explain it all a bit clearer?" and so on.
"Yes, it certainly is. No, I could not. And I was explaining very carefully," answered the wizard crossly. "If you must know more, his name is Bjorn. He's very strong, and he's a skin-changer."
"What? A furrier? A man that calls rabbits conies when he doesn't turn their skins into squirrels?" asked Bilbo.
"Good gracious heavens, no, 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 no," said Gandalf. "Don't be a fool, Mr. Baggins, if you can help it. And in the name of all wonder, don't mention the word furrier again as long as you're within 100 miles of his house, nor rug, cape, tippet, muff, nor any other such unfortunate word. He is a skin changer. He changes his skin. Sometimes he's a huge black bear, sometimes he's a great strong black-haired man with huge arms and a great beard. I cannot tell you much more, though that ought to be enough. Some say that he's a bear descended from the great and ancient bears of the mountains that lived there before the giants came. Others say that he's a man descended from the first men who lived before Smaug or the other dragons came into this part of the world, and before the goblins came into the hills out of the north. I cannot say, though I fancy the last is the true tale.
He's not the sort of person to ask questions of. At any rate, he's under no enchantment but his own. He lives in an oak wood and has a great wooden house. And as a man he keeps cattle and horses which are nearly as marvellous as himself. They work for him and talk to him. He doesn't eat them, neither does he hunt or eat wild animals. He keeps hives and hives of great fierce bees and lives most on cream and honey. As a bear he ranges far and wide. I once saw him sitting all alone on the top of the Carrick at night, watching the moon sinking towards the misty mountains, and I heard him growl in the tongue of bears, "The day will come when they will perish, and I shall go back." That is why I believe he once came from the mountains himself.
Bilbo and the dwarves had now plenty to think about, and they asked no more questions. They still had a long way to walk before them. Up slope and down dale they plodded. It grew very hot. Sometimes they rested under the trees, and then Bilbo felt so hungry that he would have eaten acorns if any had been ripe enough yet to have fallen to the ground. It was the middle of the afternoon before they noticed that great patches of flowers had begun to spring up, all the same kinds growing together as if they had been planted. Especially there was clover, waving patches of coxcomb clover and purple clover and wide stretches of short white sweet honey-smelling clover. There was a buzzing and a whirring and a droning in the air. Bees were busy everywhere, and such bees! Bilbo had never seen anything like them. "If one was to sting me," he thought, "I should swell up as big again as I am." They were bigger than hornets. The drones were bigger than your thumb, a good deal, and the bands of yellow on their deep black bodies shone like fiery gold.
"We are getting near," said Gandalf. "We're on the edge of his bee pastures."
After a while they came to a belt of tall and very ancient oaks, and beyond these to a high thorn hedge, through which you could neither see nor scramble.
"You had better wait here," said the wizard to the dwarves, "and when I call or whistle, begin to come after me. You'll see the way I go, but only in pairs, mind. About 5 minutes between each pair of you. Bomber is fattest, and will do for two. He had better come alone and last. Come on, Mr. Baggins. There's a gate somewhere round this way."
And with that he went off along the hedge, taking the frightened hobbit with him. They soon came to a wooden gate, high and broad, beyond which they could see gardens and a cluster of low wooden buildings, some thatched and made of unshaped logs, barns, stables, sheds, and a long low wooden house. Inside, on the southward side of the great hedge, were rows and rows of hives with bell-shaped tops made of straw. The noise of the giant bees flying to and fro and crawling in and out filled all the air. The wizard and the hobbit pushed open the heavy creaking gate and went down a wide track towards the house. Some horses, very sleek and well-groomed, trotted up across the grass and looked at them intently with very intelligent faces. Then off they galloped to the buildings.
"They've gone to tell him of the arrival of strangers," said Gandalf.
Soon they reached a courtyard, three walls of which were formed by the wooden house and its two long wings. In the middle there was lying a great oak trunk with many lopped branches beside it. Standing near was a huge man with a thick black beard and hair and great bare arms and legs with knotted muscles. He was clothed in a tunic of wool down to his knees and was leaning on a large axe. The horses were standing by him with their noses at his shoulder.
"Ah, here they are," he said to the horses. "They don't look dangerous. You can be off."
He laughed a great rolling laugh, put down his axe and came forward.
"Who are you, and what do you want?" he asked gruffly, standing in front of them and towering tall above Gandalf.
As for Bilbo, he could easily have trotted through his legs without ducking his head to miss the fringe of the man's brown tunic.
"I am Gandalf," said the wizard.
"Never heard of him," growled the man. "And what's this little fellow?"
he said, stooping down to frown at the hobbit with his bushy eyebrows.
"That is Mr. Baggins, a hobbit of good family and unimpeachable reputation," said Gandalf.
Bilbo bowed. He had no hat to take off, and was painfully conscious of his many missing buttons.
"I am a wizard," continued Gandalf. "I've heard of you, if you haven't heard of me. But perhaps you've heard of my good cousin Radagast, who lives near the southern borders of Mirkwood?"
"Yes, not a bad fellow as wizards go, I believe. I used to see him now and again," said Beorn. "Well, now I know who you are, or who you say you are. What do you want?"
"To tell you the truth, we've lost our luggage and nearly lost our way, and are rather in need of help, or at least advice. I may say we've had rather a bad time with goblins in the mountains."
"Goblins?" said the big man less gruffly. "Oho! So you've been having trouble with them, have you? What did you go near them for?"
"We didn't mean to. They surprised us at night in a pass which we had to cross. We were coming out of the lands over west into these countries. It's a long tale."
"Then you'd better come inside and tell me some of it, if it won't take all day,"
said the man, leading the way through a dark door that opened out of the courtyard into the house. Following him, they found themselves in a wide hall with a fireplace in the middle. Though it was summer, there was a wood fire burning, and the smoke was rising to the blackened rafters in search of the way out through an opening in the roof. They passed through this dim hall, lit only by the fire and the hole above it, and came through another smaller door into a sort of veranda propped on wooden posts made of single tree trunks. It faced south and was still warm and filled with the light of the westering sun which slanted into it, and fell golden on the garden full of flowers that came right up to the steps. Here they sat on wooden benches, while Gandalf began his tale, and Bilbo swung his dangling legs and looked at the flowers in the garden, wondering what their names could be, as he had never seen half of them before.
"I was coming over the mountains with a friend or two," said the wizard.
"Or two? I can see one, and a little one at that," said Beorn.
"Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't like to bother you with a lot of us until I found out if you were busy. I'll give a call, if I may."
"Go on, call away."
So Gandalf gave a long, shrill whistle, and presently Thorin and Dori came round the house by the garden path and stood bowing low before them.
"One or three are meant, I see," said Beorn. "But these aren't hobbits, they're dwarves."
"Thorin Oakenshield, at your service."
"Dori, at your service," said the two dwarves, bowing again.
"I don't need your service, thank you," said Beorn, "but I expect you need mine. I'm not over fond of dwarves, but if it's true, and you are Thorin, son of Thrain, son of Thror, I believe, and that your companion is respectable, and that you are enemies of goblins and are not up to any mischief in my lands. What are you up to, by the way?"
"They are on their way to visit the land of their fathers, away east beyond Mirkwood," put in Gandalf. "And it is entirely an accident that we are in your lands at all. We were crossing by the high pass that should have brought us to the road that lies to the south of your country, when we were attacked by the evil goblins, as I was about to tell you."
"Go on telling, then," said Beorn, who was never very polite.
"There was a terrible storm. The stone giants were out hurling rocks, and at the head of the pass we took refuge in a cave, the hobbit and I and several of our companions."
"Do you call two several?"
"Well, no. As a matter of fact, there were more than two."
"What are they? Killed? Eaten? Gone home?"
"Well, no. They don't seem all to have come when I whistled, Shy, I expect. You see, we're very much afraid that we're rather a lot for you to entertain. Go on, whistle again. I'm in for a party, it seems, and one or two won't make much